Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources and pull out the most important knowledge nuggets for you, our dedicated listener. I'm Chris Ruddy.
And I'm Sam Chandler. We are here to synthesize the information, connect the dots, and really drill down on the complex implications of the stories shaping our world.
Today, we are undertaking a thorough deep dive into the pages of the publication, Newsmax, for October 2025. This issue is packed. We've got high-stakes politics, warnings about global economic threats, critical health updates, and some surprising cultural trends, too.
Absolutely. And our mission here is to give you a comprehensive, really exhaustive report on every key article, every topic within this publication. We'll debate the impact and, you know, the implications for you.
Yeah, what does it all mean?
Right. And this set of sources, it really paints a picture of an incredibly polarized American political system. Foundational stuff, like legislative action, often seems secondary to just these intense battles over administrative power.
And the mechanics of democracy itself, right? Like confirmation delays, aggressive redistricting.
Exactly. It's all tied together.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting right in Washington, D.C., with this high-stakes political battlefield. Congressional roadblocks, appointment warfare. It sounds dramatic.
It really is. And we're seeing this remarkable paradox. The current administration is nominating people at a record pace.
Record-breaking speed in nominations, yeah. But then record-breaking slowness in actually getting them confirmed.
It's more than just a paradox. It's it feels like a calculated weaponization of the procedural rules. Mm-hmm. The administration nominated, 292 people in its first 100 days.
Yeah, 292, which is 3 to 4 times more than recent presidents. They came in ready to go.
They absolutely did. Ready to staff up, govern quickly. But that speed just slammed into this procedural brick wall, basically built by the minority party.
And the result is genuinely paralyzing. By Labor Day, we heard over 130 nominees. Maybe even closer to 140.
Yeah, estimates vary slightly, but it's over 130 for sure.
Still waiting for Senate confirmation. We are now seeing the longest average confirmation delays on record, significantly slower than, well, any administration in recent memory.
And what's tactically fascinating here, or maybe just frustrating depending on your view, is that the Democrats, now in the minority, are using the exact same playbook Republicans kind of perfected during the previous administration.
To drag things out.
Precisely. They're demanding exhaustive background checks, detailed ethics reviews, full financial disclosures. The argument is that this intense scrutiny is necessary because, they claim, many of the president's picks are unqualified.
Or, as Minority Leader Chuck Schumer put it, and this is a quote, if these nominees have something to hide, these documents could show it.
Right. So it's framed as due diligence, but it's also strategic. They're not just seeking information. They're deliberately forcing the majority to burn critical floor time on each nominee.
So it becomes less about the qualifications themselves and more about, you know, pulling every procedural lever you can find just to slow down the government's ability to staff itself.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans are, and predictably, accusing them of pure political stalling, calling it payback, political blackmail even, especially after the opposition failed to block that massive, big, beautiful spending bill.
And this whole gridlock really came to a head in August. There was this highly unusual negotiation attempt, which ultimately failed.
Right. Schumer offered to clear a batch of nominees, 25 non-controversial ones.
Yeah, but only in exchange for the White House releasing some pretty substantial frozen funds, money the White House had held back from various international and health programs.
These weren't small asks.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking $5 billion for the NIH, $142 million for UNICEF, $50 million for AIDS programs, and $300 million for Gaza humanitarian assistance.
That's huge leverage.
That's not just about appointments anymore, is it? It's using appointments to try and force foreign aid and health spending policy.
Exactly. And the whole thing collapsed, apparently, when Schumer insisted on getting a written guarantee that the White House wouldn't try any more forced spending cuts before October 1st. The trust just wasn't there.
No kidding. The whole episode just shows how the normal legislative process has been completely sidelined. It's all about these procedural choke points now.
Indeed. Though despite the collapse, the Senate Majority Leader John Thune did manage to muscle through a few key confirmations by delaying the summer recess.
Yes, like Mielbo to the third to an appeals court. That's significant.
Mm-hmm.
And the controversial confirmation of Jeanine Pirro as U.S. Attorney for D.C.
Right. So some movement, but at a glacial pace compared to the number of vacancies.
So given this scale of tactical warfare, the obvious question is, will Senate Republicans finally try to change the rules? use the nuclear option for appointments, maybe.
Well, they certainly talked about it, explored it, along with the idea of using recess appointments, which Senator Tom Tillis was strongly against, by the way.
Interesting.
But the sources say that some really influential, long-serving senators, people like Lisa Murkowski and, significantly, former leader Mitch McConnell, they voiced serious concerns.
About changing the rules.
Yeah. Their thinking was more institutional. They argued that weakening the Senate's authority now, even for a short-term game, would absolutely backfire the moment the GOP finds itself back in the minority.
A classic dilemma. Immediate tactical victory versus preserving long-term institutional power for the minority, whoever that might be.
Precisely. It's a very tough calculation.
That deep structural conflict, that tension, it transitions us perfectly into the next major political battleground discussed here, the redistricting wars, which are aggressively shaping who controls Congress in the next cycle, long before anyone even casts a vote.
Yeah, mid-decade map-making, gerrymandering, it's as old as the Republic itself, practically. But this time, these dueling, really aggressive efforts in the two biggest states, Texas and California, it feels like it's setting a genuinely corrosive precedent.
Okay, let's break that down. Start with the GOP offensive in Texas. Republican allies there successfully pushed through a brand new map, and it could potentially yield them 5 additional congressional seats.
5 seats, yeah. By redrawing districts around major population hubs like Austin, Dallas, Houston, and also South Texas. Now, the supporters, they claim it ensures more accurate representation because of shifting demographics.
Okay, fair enough. That's their argument. Meanwhile, California Democrats, seeing this, launched an immediate counteroffensive.
They did. They're backing something called Proposition 50, which is going to be on a special election ballot November 4th. Mm-hmm. And it would temporarily give the legislature the power to redraw congressional lines.
And their argument is explicitly retaliatory, isn't it?
Oh, completely. They're basically saying we can't let California voters be disadvantaged while other states, especially Texas, are aggressively exploiting mid-decade redistricting. It's pure tit for tat.
So the great paradox here, as the sources suggest, is that these hyper-partisan dueling efforts might actually cancel each other out on a national level.
Yeah.
5 seats gained by the GOP in Texas, potentially 5 gained by the Democrats in California.
That's awesome.
Nationally, maybe. But the deeper implication, the real damage done, that's the worry. The sources warn this aggressive tit-for-tat reflects a profound erosion of trust. And it effectively opens Pandora's box for potentially a new permanent cycle of retaliatory gerrymandering all across the country.
It really forces us to confront that core philosophical debate in American democracy, doesn't it? What is fair representation?
Absolutely. Partisan mapmakers, they argue that because Democratic voters are so heavily concentrated in urban areas, the maps naturally tilt Republican elsewhere. They say those urban Democratic votes are effectively wasted in these huge safe districts.
And they also argue safe districts allow for stability, seniority for legislators, which has value.
Right. But the counterargument is so visually compelling sometimes. Opponents say gerrymandering just lets politicians choose their voters, which undermines the whole idea of democracy.
The Massachusetts example in the source material really drives this home.
It does. The GOP regularly wins 40% of the statewide vote there, a huge chunk, but holds 0 U.S. House or Senate seats. 0.
Wow. 40% of the vote. 0 representation at the federal level.
It's a clear demonstration of how political geography, when it's manipulated, can just warp representation. You concentrate this massive voting block into a few districts, leaving them with disproportionately low power overall.
That is a staggering detail.
Okay.
Moving from the halls of Congress and state legislatures to the heart of America's largest city, the next major political battle is unfolding in New York. The sources here warn only huge turnout can stop in your electing socialist mayor.
Yeah, we're talking about Zohran Mamdani. He's a hard left democratic socialist, and he's unexpectedly cruising toward potentially becoming the first Muslim mayor of New York City, which, you know, is a city with the largest Jewish populations outside of Israel. The political tension there is just palpable.
And the polling from August, it's stark for the establishment candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Mamdani was consistently leading the field, polling around 44%.
Way ahead of the others. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo was back at 25%, Curtis Sliwa at 12%, and the current mayor, Eric Adams, trailing pretty significantly.
What makes this so alarming for his opponents, according to the analysis, is that even if they manage to consolidate the entire anti-Mamdani vote behind just one rival, say Cuomo,
which some figures, like President Trump, were promoting as a strategy.
Right. Even then, Mamdani still wins in hypothetical head-to-head contests. He pulls 42% to Kuromo's 31%. The progressive base seems incredibly mobilized for him.
Yeah, that base is fired up. And his platform, dubbed a woke utopia by The Source, is certainly designed to excite them.
Some really ambitious proposals detailed here. A citywide rent freeze.
Across the board.
Free bus rides for everyone. An astonishing 800% increase to hate violence prevention programs. And maybe the most radical, city-owned grocery stores.
City-owned groceries that would pay no rent or property taxes and would buy and sell at wholesale prices. The idea is to undercut private competition.
It's a vision for a fundamentally redesigned city structure.
Absolutely. And this is also where the political debate gets incredibly toxic. The source material lays out 5 specific points of criticism leveled against Mamdani, especially regarding his stance after the October 7th attack.
Okay, what are they? We need to report this impartially.
Right. The criticisms include lasting Israel for occupation and apartheid the day after the Hamas attack without criticizing Hamas itself, defending the controversial phrase, globalize the Intifada, his longstanding support for the BDS movement,
okay,
his refusal to disavow a polarizing streamer named Hassan Piker, and not signing resolutions that condemn the Holocaust or honored Israel.
And we absolutely must state that Mamdani's campaign has dismissed these accusations. They call them cynical political efforts designed purely to censor him and undermine his campaign.
That's their counter. But this highly charged environment, it really defines the only clear path to defeating him, according to analysis by Betsy McCaughey, the former GOP lieutenant governor.
What's her take?
Her analysis suggests Mamdani's primary vote total, around 469,000 votes, is probably near his absolute ceiling in a high turnout general election.
So key is turnout, massive turnout.
Exactly. She argues the only way to beat him is to achieve 50% turnout or even higher, specifically from very particular demographic groups.
Which ones?
Asian communities first, many of whom have lived experience or family histories that make them deeply fearful of his more communist-leaning policies, like those city-owned grocery stores. And second, crucially, homeowners in the outer boroughs. People horrified by the prospect of a rent freeze potentially devastating property values and the city's tax base.
So mobilizing those specific groups is the strategy.
It has to be, according to this analysis. But we also have to acknowledge the demographic reality here. New York City's Muslim population is about 9%. That's a highly motivated voting bloc, likely to turn out strongly for Mamdani.
Boosting his numbers.
Right. And his base is already seen as young, white, educated, often transient renters who probably prioritize his social policies over, say, long-term fiscal stability. So it really sets up this battle, highly motivated niche groups versus mobilizing a broader, perhaps less naturally enthusiastic electorate.
It sets the stage for a really dramatic election with potentially national implications. Okay, let's pivot now from these electoral battles to the immediate on-the-ground impact of current administration policy, specifically tackling crime. The source material has a striking case study titled Trump Tames Crime in Blue Cities.
Yeah, this article focuses entirely on the District of Columbia. Back in August, the president ordered a major federal intervention there, deployed over 500 federal law enforcement officers, plus about 800 National Guard troops.
Effectively doubling the number of patrol officers on the streets in D.C.
Doubling them, yeah. And the immediate results reported were, well, astounding, specifically looking at the 20 days right after the takeover, August 7th to the 26th.
What did they find?
Violent crime plummeted by 45%. Carjackings, down to shopping 87%. Robbery dropped 62%. Sexual abuse fell 44%.
87% drop in carjackings. That's incredible.
It's a massive decrease. And maybe most tellingly, homicides dropped to 0 for 13 consecutive days, something the city hadn't seen in years.
Wow. So the source material draws a pretty powerful, maybe simple thesis from this.
It does. Quote, crime goes down as the risk of arrest, conviction, and punishment goes up. The D.C. case, they argue, demonstrated that a rapid, significant, highly visible increase in law enforcement, combined with immediate accountability, it saves lives and cuts violent crime, at least in the short term.
Okay, that D.C. data is compelling. But does the analysis grapple with the long-term feasibility? I mean, is the implication that you need a heavy, continuous federal presence, essentially doubling the police force permanently to sustain those results? What about the cost?
That's the critical question the article kind of leaves hanging, isn't it? The D.C. intervention highlights the immediate impact of a surge, a crackdown. but it contrasts so sharply with the philosophy in other major cities like Chicago.
Right, where Mayor Brandon Johnson resisted federal intervention.
Exactly. Johnson's argument, which the source disputes pretty strongly, is that just jailing offenders is counterproductive in the long run. It doesn't address the systemic root causes of crime.
Two very different approaches. What's particularly revealing, though, is the data deep dive in the source about the 20 most dangerous cities.
Yes, this was interesting. It notes that while 12 of these cities are actually located in states that lean Republican, so-called red states, nearly all 20 of those dangerous cities are run by Democrats.
Ah, so state politics might not be the key factor here.
That's the implication. And the historical context they provide is stark. St. Louis hasn't had a Republican mayor since 1949. Atlanta, 1879. New Orleans, 1872.
Wow. Since the 19th century for some.
Right. So the implication the source pushes is clear. The political leaning of the state might not be the dominant factor in these persistent high crime rates. It might be decades, even centuries, of specific local governance and policies. Policies that, in these particular cities, have been largely uncorrected by the progressive political machine for a very, very long time.
That's a profound implication, suggesting that maybe permissive local policies, regardless of the state's overall leaning, could be directly creating the environment where crime flourishes, which then seems to require this kind of massive federal intervention to correct, at least temporarily.
Exactly. It really shifts the focus, or the blame narrative, if you like, from state-level politics down to specific municipal decisions about policing, prosecution, social programs, the whole local package.
Fascinating. Okay, from the streets to the nation's balance sheet, let's pivot to a really urgent issue, the Social Security fiscal emergency. The administration recently claimed the safety net is more resilient than ever, but experts, both inside and outside government, are sounding some pretty dire alarms.
Yeah, despite that comforting rhetoric from the president, the June 2025 Social Security Trustees Report projects that the main trust fund, the Old Age and Survivors Insurance, or OASI, it's going to exhaust its reserves by the end of 2033.
2033, that's soon. And it's a full year earlier than they previously estimated, right?
Exactly. The urgency has definitely ramped up.
And the impact on recipients, 70 million of them, is very real. Without major immediate reform, they're facing benefit cuts between 17% and 23%.
Which translates, for an average senior, to potentially losing between $10,000 and $16,500 a year. I mean, for people depending on those checks as their primary income, that's truly what Alex Lawson from Social Security Works called a total and complete catastrophe.
Unthinkable for many. What's the root cause? Is it just demographics?
It's largely demographics, which makes it so politically difficult to fix. The worker-to-recipient ratio is just shrinking rapidly. Back in 1965, it was four workers supporting each retiree.
4 to 1.
Today, it's down to 2.7 to 1, and it's projected to fall even further, to 2.1 to 1 by the year 2100. Costs have been exceeding the income from taxes since 2021.
So we're already drawing down reserves.
Yes. And by 2033, that annual shortfall is expected to hit over $414 billion. The money coming in simply won't cover the payouts going out under the current structure.
So what's the administration's approach? The source mentions focusing on fraud, waste, and abuse.
Right, primarily through this new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which is, yes, playfully named after the cryptocurrency mascot.
DOGE.
And DOGE's task is basically to root out federal bureaucracy and waste. They had a recent update proudly announcing they'd purged 12.3 million individuals aged 120 and over from the Social Security rolls, marking them as deceased.
12.3 million people over 120. Okay, that seems like necessary cleanup. Saving millions, presumably.
Definitely necessary. But economists like Andrew Biggs, who studies this closely, caution that while cutting fraud is absolutely essential, it won't fix the core mathematical solvency issue by itself. It's just not big enough.
So real, probably painful political solutions are still needed. Biggs supports revenue side reforms, right?
Right.
Like changing the payroll tax cap.
Yes, specifically eliminating or at least significantly raising the current cap on income subject to the payroll tax, which is $176,100 for 2025.
So anyone earning above that doesn't pay Social Security tax on the extra income.
Correct. It disproportionately affects middle income earners relative to their total income. Biggs argues that eliminating or raising that cap would drastically increase revenue from higher earners, making it a mathematically viable solution. Politically controversial, of course, he also suggests raising the retirement age gradually to 69.
Right. Also politically tough.
Yeah.
But Are there more creative, maybe bipartisan solutions being floated?
Yeah.
Ones that try to sidestep the direct pain of tax hikes or benefit cuts?
There are. The Cassidy-Cain proposal is a prime example mentioned. It's a bipartisan bill, and it proposes investing a huge chunk of upfront capital, $1.5 trillion, into a parallel investment fund.
A parallel fund? How would that work?
The idea is that it functions like a massive endowment. That $1.5 trillion seed money wouldn't just sit there, it would be invested in higher return assets, stocks, bonds, over a 75-year horizon. It's modeled on the National Railroad Retirement Investment Trust, which has actually been quite successful.
So take the funding issue partially out of the annual budget fight and put it into a long-term investment structure. Interesting.
It aims to make it more politically palatable, avoids those direct hits.
In the meantime, though, the administration did sign the One Big Beautiful Bill, the OBBB, back in July 2025. That provided some immediate relief.
Yes, immediate tax relief. It offers a $6,000 tax deduction for individuals 65 and older, up to $12,000 for couples. And it's phased out only for very high earners.
And it also created these Trump accounts.
Right. These are $1,000 savings accounts provided to every U.S. citizen child born between January 2025 and January 2029. The funds are invested privately, grow tax-free until adulthood. It's essentially creating a massive, privately managed savings program for the next generation alongside Social Security.
Lots of moving parts. But the ultimate obstacle seems to remain political will, doesn't it? Andrew Biggs observed that the no-cuts position has really shifted left and become the political center of gravity now.
Absolutely. Lawmakers face this immovable political truth. Nobody wants to risk touching benefits directly because, as we all know, seniors have a kind of superpower. They always, always turn out to vote.
So the political calculus basically guarantees that lawmakers will find some fix, right? Whether it's complex investment schemes, hidden tax adjustments, something, long before they actually risk cutting a direct benefit check.
That seems to be the consensus, yes. They'll kick the can, find creative financing, anything but direct cuts.
Okay. Now let's turn our attention to one of the most visible political figures outside the White House these days, California Governor Gavin Newsom, featured here in a profile bluntly titled, Gavin Newsom Nepo Baby.
Oof. Yeah, the central theme of the book referenced in this piece is deeply skeptical, let's say. It argues Newsom's political rise isn't really from humble beginnings or pure merit. It claims he owes almost everything to deep connections with three incredibly powerful California families, the Newsoms themselves, the Pelosis, and the Gettys.
And the source frames this powerful backing as enabling his capacity for what it calls aggressive prevarication, basically mastering the art of bending the truth.
That's the charge. The source argues Newsom paints California as this Eden of economic growth, but claims the facts behind his boasts are constantly manipulated. For instance, he claimed in a high-profile debate that California saw significant growth in population and record-breaking tourism.
Okay, standard political claims. How does the source dissect them?
Well, it attributes the alleged population growth directly to what it calls, and this is their phrasing, Biden's sinisterly executed flood of illegals, not organic economic growth. And the record tourism claim. When you adjust for inflation and rising costs, what the source calls Bidenflation, it argues that in real dollar terms, tourism was actually down.
The numbers behind the numbers. What about the broader economy? California is huge.
It is the world's fourth largest economy, as he likes to point out. But the source undercuts this by highlighting its recent growth rate. Between 2020 and 2023, California's yearly economic growth averaged only 2.3%. That lags significantly behind competitors like Florida, which averaged 4.6%, and Texas at 3.9%.
So big, but not growing as fast as rivals. And his personal wealth.
Significant. He reported about $950,000 in assets when he started in politics at age 28. Today, his net worth is estimated north of $25 million.
That's quite an increase. The Nepo Baby thesis really leans on the family network details, right?
Heavily. Newsom's father, Bill Newsom, wasn't just a friend of the Gettys. He was Gordon Getty's college roommate and later managed the multi-billion dollar Gordon P. Getty Family Trust.
And the governor named his business empire Plump Jack.
After a specific opera written by Gordon Getty himself, the source presents this as clear evidence of the mechanism of wealth and opportunity transfer. It wasn't just luck.
And the political pedigree extends further. Through the Browns and Pelosis.
Yes. Newsom Sr. worked closely with former Governor Pat Brown. And Pat Brown, in turn, awarded an Olympic ski concession to both Bill Newsom and John Pelosi, who happened to be Nancy Pelosi's father-in-law. It's all very interconnected at the top.
The profile also touches on personal scandals, neutrally reporting them.
Yes, it mentions Newsom's own public scandal cheating on his first wife, Kimberly Guilfoyle. And it also highlights the prior relationship between Kamala Harris, who was then a 29-year-old prosecutor, and Willie Brown, who was 60, married, and the powerful former Speaker of the Assembly. Brand gave her some plum appointments during that time.
So the source uses these examples not just as gossip, but to illustrate how political power seems concentrated and transferred within a small, interconnected elite in California.
That's exactly the argument it's making. These aren't isolated incidents. They're part of a pattern.
What's particularly interesting now, though, is Newsom's communication strategy for his national ambitions. He's adopted these Trumpy social media tactics.
Fully embraced them, according to the source. Using all key PPS, aggressive nicknames like TACO, which stands for Trump, always chickens, out to directly engage with the president.
I do that.
Two reasons, it seems. One, to get under the president's skin and grab headlines. Two, and maybe more importantly, to energize Democrats, many of whom feel their party leaders are often too passive, too reactive. Newsom is being deliberately provocative.
And it seems to be working for him, profile-wise.
It is, absolutely. By using the opposition's own aggressive language, he elevates his national profile significantly. Recent polling mentioned here puts him second only to Kamala Harris among likely candidates for the 2028 Democratic presidential nomination. He's mastering this new political language of antagonism.
Quite the strategist.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that transition takes us neatly from domestic political warfare to the global stage, specifically global economic competition. There's a stark warning here about the Chinese EV threat.
Yeah, this story kicks off with a really striking anecdote, something that should probably send shivers down the spine of every auto executive in Detroit. Ford CEO Jim Farley personally drove a Chinese EV, the Xiaomi SU7.
And what do you think?
He didn't just drive it. He apparently raved about it, called it fantastic, noted its performance rivals some Porsche models, and it includes extremely advanced AI features, and it's priced around $30,000.
$30,000 for Porsche-level performance and advanced AI. That's disruptive.
Hugely. And the fundamental problem for the U.S. isn't just the quality anymore, which is now clearly competitive. It's the price, which is heavily subsidized.
How much subsidy are we talking?
Chinese manufacturers benefit from aggressive state subsidies, reportedly up to $10,000 per vehicle. This lets them sell at a loss internationally, create massive global overcapacity, and just drive down prices everywhere.
And the result?
China now controls something like 70% of global EV production. Meanwhile, the average price of U.S.-made EV is still around $55,000. The gap is enormous.
The source calls this an extinction-level event for traditional automakers. It sounds extreme.
It does, but the Alliance for American Manufacturing uses that exact phrase. Their estimate is that if the U.S. loses significant market share to these subsidized imports, it could cost up to 130,000 direct U.S. auto jobs by 2030. Not to mention the ripple effects through the supply chain and losing future tech leadership.
And there's a national security angle here too, right, with the advanced AI Farley mentioned.
Yes, that's the other edge of the threat. It's not just economic. Those advanced features, the complex data connectivity, they raise the chilling possibility that a Chinese-controlled vehicle could become a mobile surveillance platform, potentially reporting sensitive location data, maybe even audio or video, back to the CCP. That's a strategic threat that has to be countered.
So what are the countermeasures? The Trump administration is proposing tariffs.
Very aggressive ones, 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs, essentially trying to block direct imports entirely.
But tariffs are just a shield.
Right.
They don't necessarily win the race long term.
Exactly. They protect the domestic market, but they don't build competitiveness. The ultimate strategy, as detailed in the source, has to be about innovation. It means adopting that Elon Musk playbook, pushing hard on next-generation batteries, perfecting full self-driving technology, creating those robust post-purchase software update ecosystems that Chinese competitors maybe can't easily match yet.
And partnerships
for
materials.
Yeah, crucial. The U.S. needs strategic partnerships with resource-rich allies like Australia and Canada to secure the critical minerals, lithium, rare earths needed for batteries. We can't rely on China for those either.
It requires real, sustained industrial policy and will, doesn't it, to make sure the U.S. and its allies don't just surrender a defining 21st century industry to subsidize state actors.
That's the challenge laid out here, yes. A long-term strategic fight.
Okay, shifting now to a geopolitical context, framing a different kind of war, the battle for truth. We're looking at the ongoing conflict involving Israel.
Right. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted praising Newsmax specifically for aiding Israel in what he calls the Eighth Front in its ongoing war.
The Eighth Front.
Yeah, he explicitly frames Israel's conflict as a seven-front war fighting Iran and its various proxies across the region, plus this crucial Eighth Front, which is the battle of truth fought against global misinformation, in the media, on social channels.
And this statement comes nearly 2 years after the horrific October 7th attacks in 2023.
Yes. Which resulted in 11,195 deaths, and tragically, dozens of hostages are still being held. The conflict remains incredibly intense, and the source highlights recent atrocities too, like the July 27th, 2024 Hezbollah rocket attack that killed 12 Druze children in the Golan Heights. It's still very much ongoing.
Netanyahu used this platform to directly push back against accusations of genocide or starvation policies in Gaza.
He did. He cited data showing Israel has facilitated the delivery of nearly 2 million tons of food and medical aid into Gaza, and he drew this stark visual contrast, pictures of what he called corpulent, well-fed Hamas captors next to images of emaciated Israeli hostages. His argument is that Hamas itself is the party enforcing starvation policies on its own people to benefit its fighters, not Israel.
A grim comparison. Former U.S. Ambassador David Friedman also weighed in, drawing a firm conclusion from all this.
Yes. Friedman concludes, according to the source, that the long-standing policy of ceding territory to Palestinians, whether it was Gaza withdrawal or potentially Judea and Samaria, has categorically failed. His bottom line is that Israel must remain one Jewish state to ensure its long-term security. No more land for peace attempts.
That hard-line conclusion and the fight for truth and accountability, or the lack thereof, it transitions quite neatly into another ongoing saga mentioned in the Back Talk section, the Jeffrey Epstein affair.
Yeah, the article uses the headline, "Epstein Saga Smells Like Rotting Fish," which really captures the broad public disgust and suspicion surrounding it. The core issue is this deep public concern that the wealthy and well-connected seem to operate above the law, avoiding any real justice.
People are frustrated by what feels like two systems of justice, aren't they? In this incredibly high-profile case, it seems only Ghislaine Maxwell and the sort of ostracized Prince Andrew have faced any significant consequences.
Right. And the source notes the impending posthumous memoir from accuser Virginia Giuffre, titled Nobody's Girl, and it highlights the continued loud demand from victims and the public for the courts to finally release the names of the other prominent men allegedly involved in Epstein's abuse network.
The parallel is quite compelling, isn't it? Whether you're talking about the global stage, like Israel facing misinformation, or the highest echelons of society with Epstein, there's this fierce, unmet demand for truth and accountability.
It resonates deeply with the public that feels like the powerful often escape scrutiny.
Okay, let's pivot now to the media battles themselves. Focusing on the Newsmax business landscape, this section covers their own litigation, settlements, and strategy. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, it shows Newsmax taking some pretty aggressive strategic steps, particularly against its main competitor, Fox News. They've filed a major antitrust lawsuit.
Antitrust, what's the core allegation?
The claim is that Fox News used exclusionary contracts and, frankly, intimidation tactics to extract what Newsmax calls super competitive carriage fees from cable and satellite distributors.
Meaning they charged way too much.
That's the argument. Specifically, they allege Fox charged distributors nearly $2.20 per subscriber per month, which is reportedly double what CNN gets and six times what MSNBC gets.
Yeah, six times MSNBC.
If true, yes. The argument Newsmax is making is simple. This anti-competitive behavior harmed Newsmax directly, stifled competition in the marketplace for right-leaning news, and ultimately reduced consumer choice, denying millions of Americans alternative viewpoints. They're seeking significant monetary damages and injunctions to try and level the playing field.
A big legal fight.
Mm.
On the other side of the legal coin, though, Newsmax also settled that high-profile defamation lawsuit with Dominion Voting Systems stemming from the 2020 election reporting.
They did. Newsmax, in their statement, maintained that their original reporting was fair and balanced, consistent with journalistic standards. They argued it was important for the public to hear both sides of the election disputes.
But they settled anyway.
Their explicit reason, stated in the source, was their determination that they simply could not get a fair trial in the Delaware court presided over by Judge Eric Davis. They cited rulings they felt strongly favored Dominion and created a presumption of guilt. So, settling was a strategic decision, likely reflecting the high cost and the perceived unpredictability of continuing that specific litigation battle.
Makes sense from a risk management perspective. Despite these big legal battles, though, the company seems financially healthy.
Apparently so. Their second quarter 2025 revenue was up a significant 28.5% compared to the previous year. Advertising revenues jumped 26.2%. So the core business seems strong.
And they made a key strategic move for future growth, focusing on streaming.
Exactly. They added David Gandler, the co-founder and CEO of FuboTV, to their board of directors. That signals a really strong focus on expanding their own streaming service, Newsmax plus Dailashi. It's a clear nod to the future, recognizing that consumers are steadily migrating away from traditional cable bundles towards streaming options.
A crucial move for any media company right now. Okay, let's leave the political and media arenas now and explore some of the more personal health and lifestyle stories featured in these sources. Starting with something nearly 70% of us apparently agree on, the clock change debate.
That's right. It seems the biannual time change, bringing forward, falling back, is deeply unpopular. Most Americans are just tired of it. They cite it as a major nuisance. It disrupts sleep patterns. It might even be detrimental to overall health. Even President Trump called it a costly ordeal.
Okay, so we agree we don't like it, but the consensus completely breaks down when we talk about the alternative, right? We still have this perpetual divide.
We do. Option one, year-round daylight saving time, or DST. That's supported by Senator Rick Scott's Sunshine Protection Act, the big appeal. Later sunsets in the evening, all year round. More light for activities after work or school.
Sounds good. What's the trade-off?
The significant trade-off for permanent DST is really dark winter mornings, especially in northern states. For example, Minneapolis would see sunrise at nearly 9 a.m., 8.51. Seattle, almost the same, 8.57 a.m. That really disrupts school schedules, commutes, morning routines.
Okay, that's a big downside. What's the other option?
Option two, year-round standard time, or ST. This is supported by Senator Todd Young and, importantly, backed by many medical professionals like sleep specialist Dr. Corinne Johnson.
Why do they prefer standard time?
They argue it's simply the healthiest option because it aligns our internal body clocks, our circadian rhythms, much better with the actual solar time, the sun's position. This ensures better sleep quality and overall physical well-being.
But the downside of permanent standard time.
Much earlier summer sunsets. In a city like Boston, for example, the summer sunrise would be incredibly early, like 4.07 a.m., and the sun would set earlier in the evening, cutting short those long summer evening activities many people enjoy.
So it's a real conflict. Social utility versus biological alignment. What do people actually prefer? The source mentioned a Gallup poll.
Yeah, interestingly, that poll showed 48% of Americans actually favor standard time year-round, which suggests that despite the political momentum often behind DST, Sunshine Protection Act, etc., ST might be the underlying preference for nearly half the population. And Dr. Johnson argues strongly that DST is especially harmful for teenagers, forcing them to wake up an hour earlier than their natural body clocks want them to during school months.
That's a fascinating point about teens. Okay, moving to new approaches to health and wellness. The sources really push for advanced cholesterol testing, arguing the standard test most of us get isn't really adequate.
Yeah, the core message is clear. They cite cardiologist Chauncey Crandall discussing a patient who looked perfectly healthy, slim, fit, normal, standard lipid profile, yet still faced a high risk of heart attack. The standard test just measures total cholesterol levels, LDL, HDL, triglycerides, which can sometimes be misleading.
So what's the better test we should be asking for?
It's called the Advanced Lipid Panel, and the key difference is that it assesses cholesterol particles, specifically something called apolipoprotein B, or ApoB.
Apo. How is that different?
Think of it this way. The standard LDL cholesterol number is like measuring the total weight of potentially bad traffic on a highway. The ApoB measurement, however, is like counting the actual number of vehicles, the individual lipoprotein particles, which are the things that actually burrow into artery walls and cause plaque.
So it's counting the troublemakers, not just the total volume.
Exactly. And research found that the ApoB particle count was the single largest predictor of coronary heart disease risk, even in people whose standard cholesterol numbers looked perfectly normal.
So the implication is simple.
Right.
If you have normal cholesterol on a standard test, but you have other risk factors, family history, high blood pressure, diabetes, whatever, you should really ask your doctor specifically for this advanced ApoB panel.
Push for it. The source notes, it's generally covered by insurance if medically indicated. It gives a much clearer picture of your actual risk.
Good advice. Okay, the next surprising insight is about the gravity of health, how gravity affects us more than we think.
Right. This features research from Dr. Brennan Spiegel, who focuses on something called gravity intolerance. He suggests it might be linked to common frustrating conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or IBS. His argument is that humans evolved to spend about two-thirds of their day upright, constantly engaging with gravity, and our modern sedentary lifestyles might be disrupting that relationship.
Interesting theory. Does he offer practical tips? How do we work with gravity better?
He does, and they're very practical. For gut health, think about mechanical alignment. Using something like a squatty potty or even just a footstool when you're on the toilet. It changes your body position, aligns things better for smoother, easier elimination. It helps the gut do its job working with gravity.
Okay, makes sense. What about back pain?
Back pain often signals the body is struggling against gravity. So things like standing desks or using balance boards while you work, they force better posture. They make your core muscles engage more to stabilize you against gravity's pull.
And he also mentioned a really critical immediate tip for dizziness.
Yes, this is super useful. If you suddenly feel dizzy or lightheaded, often due to a drop in blood pressure, the fastest way to counteract gravity's effect on your blood flow is to immediately bend over. Get your head below the level of your heart.
Why does that help?
It instantly helps gravity push blood back towards your brain, which can often prevent fainting and alleviate the dizziness very quickly. Simple physics, but effective.
Good one to remember. Okay, let's talk about the microscopic world inside us, feeding the bugs in your gut.
Yes, the gut microbiome, often called the second brain, and for good reason. It influences just about everything, metabolism, nutrient absorption, even our cognition and mood. It's incredibly important.
And there's a new tool highlighted here, an index to rate foods for gut health.
Right. It's called the Dietary Index for Gut Microbiota, or DIGM. It basically rates specific foods based on how beneficial they are likely to be for our internal ecosystem of microbes. It gives you a clearer guide than just eat fiber.
So what kind of foods score highly on this DIGM index?
Top scoring foods tend to be rich in certain types of fibers or fermentation products. Things like fermented dairy yogurt, kefir, which contain live beneficial cultures, and surprisingly, chickpeas score very highly.
Chickpeas? Why?
They're rich in something called resistant starch, which our own digestive system doesn't break down well, but our gut bacteria absolutely love to feast on it. When they ferment it, they produce beneficial compounds called short-chain fatty acids, which are great for gut health and overall health.
Fascinating. And what foods score poorly?
On the low-scoring end, you find things like refined grains, white bread, pastries, and generally high-fat diets.
Yeah.
These tend to disrupt the healthy balance of microbes, feeding the less beneficial ones.
The powerful takeaway here seems to be about empowerment, right?
Absolutely. While you can't change your genetics or how you were born, which also influences your microbiome, your diet and lifestyle choices are the key levers you control every single day to keep those trillions of little gut buddies happy and working efficiently for you.
Feed your bugs well. Okay, and finally, in the realm of mental health, there's a truly fascinating and, maybe for some, surprising new therapeutic tool mentioned. Dungeons and Dragons therapy.
Yeah, D&D. The classic tabletop role-playing game. Once kind of vilified back in the 80s during the Satanic Panic, it's now emerging as a potentially viable structured tool for psychological exploration and therapy.
How does that even work? Using a game for therapy.
The core psychological mechanism is actually pretty ingenious. Players create and use an avatar, a character they play in the game's fantasy world. This avatar allows them to safely explore deep psychological issues, maybe social anxiety, maybe trauma, maybe relationship boundaries, without any real-world consequences.
So if your character fails at something in the game.
Right, if your character fails a social check or makes a mistake, the player doesn't fail personally. It creates this safe distance, this buffer for experimentation and exploration.
Are there specific benefits for certain conditions?
The source suggests yes, surprisingly specific benefits. For individuals struggling with depression, the game can provide an immediate sense of worth and purpose. Your character has unique skills the group depends on. You achieve goals together. That can be powerful.
What about ADHD?
For those with ADHD, the game's inherent high interest, its clear goals, and its structured turn-taking can actually help improve focus and sustained attention in a way that's engaging, not tedious.
And PTSD or trauma.
Crucially, for people dealing with trauma or PTSD, D&D can provide a safe, fantastical environment for controlled emotional expression. A player who struggles with paralyzing anxiety in real life, for instance, might design their character as a charismatic, fearless warrior. This allows them to vicariously practice courageous actions and social leadership from that safe psychological distance.
So it's like a collaborative fantasy adventure that helps you gain real-world insights and maybe practice new behaviors.
Exactly. It's a really brilliant example of reframing a popular culture pastime into a potentially legitimate therapeutic intervention, especially when guided by a trained therapist.
Very cool. Okay, that brings us nicely to smart financial moves in discovery, starting with 12 ways to score free stuff. I mean, who doesn't want to find ways to get quick financial wins or knowledge by, you know, exploiting existing systems?
Right. We all love freebies. And the sources list some highly practical ways to find real value. A prime example is leveraging credit card rewards and online shopping portals.
How does that work?
You can use platforms linked to cards like Capital One or browser extensions like Rakuten or Honey to earn significant cash back, sometimes up to 30%, or rewards points at major retailers just for clicking through their link before you shop online. If you're not doing this, you are literally leaving money on the table every time you shop online.
Good point. What else?
Check the perks attached to financial products you might already have. Many credit cards offer benefits beyond just points, things like free streaming subscriptions, Netflix, Disney Plus, valuable travel insurance, or credits for services like TSA PreCheck or Global Entry that save you time and hassle at the airport.
And birthday freebies? Are they ever actually worth it?
Some are. The article mentions getting a $30 gift card at Benihana during your birthday month or a free Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's. Small things, but they add up and they're easy to get.
What about free classes or access?
Yeah, places like Home Depot offer free DIY workshops. Williams-Sonoma has free cooking technique classes. Apple stores run free today at Apple sessions on creativity and tech skills. And Bank of America customers get free admission to hundreds of museums nationwide on the first full weekend of every month through their Museums on Us program.
That's a great tip. And specific perks for seniors and veterans.
Absolutely. Adults 62 and older can buy a lifetime National Parks Pass for just $80. That's incredible value if you travel. And veterans and Gold Star families can get a free lifetime America the Beautiful Pass, granting access to hundreds of national parks and federal recreation sites. Huge potential savings there.
Okay, lots of ways to save a bit here and there. The last piece of discovery mentioned is more about collecting and history. The public release of a cache of 571 last year, 1904, New Orleans Morgan silver dollars.
Yes, this is fascinating for history buffs and collectors. These aren't just any silver dollars. The New Orleans Mint holds a unique place in U.S. history.
Why is it unique?
It's the only U.S. Mint facility ever to have struck coins for three different American governments. The U.S. federal government, the state of Louisiana briefly during the Civil War, and the Confederate States of America. That adds a layer of historical intrigue.
And the 1904 Morgan dollar itself is scarce.
Extremely scarce in high grades. Experts estimate that only about 0.57%, barely half of 1% of all Morgan silver dollars ever struck, survived the various mass meltings ordered by the government over the years. Most were melted down for their silver content.
So finding a cache of uncirculated ones from the final year is significant.
Very significant. This particular cache release is of brilliant uncirculated coins, and they're being offered at $89 to $99 each. The source notes this is a substantial discount compared to the $163 price these coins often fetch nationally from dealers.
So an opportunity for collectors. And it's a tangible piece of American history too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Reminds you of a different time.
Absolutely. The article points out that back in 1904, that single $1 silver coin could buy you 7 dozen eggs or 6 pounds of flour. It really underscores the power of scarcity, history, and perceived value in determining what something is worth, proving that physical assets still hold enormous appeal, even in our increasingly digital world.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a lot of ground today. Everything from the political gridlock paralyzing the Senate, the aggressive economic warfare posed by Chinese EVs, and the potential security risks they bring.
To the battle for truth being fought in the Middle East and in media boardrooms right here, and even the surprising therapeutic benefits of playing Dungeons and Dragons.
So what are the major threads weaving through this whole deep dive for you?
I think a few things really stand out. First, despite massive shifts potentially happening in political control and policy direction, the actual machinery of government in D.C. still seems defined by this deep procedural paralysis and gridlock. Change is hard to implement.
Yeah, the system itself resists.
Second, we see this urgent, mathematically defined need for a bipartisan fix for Social Security. That 2033 deadline is looming, and the political calculations involved in any potential solution are just incredibly intense. It's a ticking clock.
And we learn that geopolitics is surprisingly close to home, isn't it? whether it's talking about 100% tariffs potentially hitting the price or availability of electric cars you might want to buy, or even the media outlets you rely on for information facing their own existential battles.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe most personally, we saw this really critical shift in the health focus, moving strongly towards prevention and lifestyle, urging you, the listener, to look beyond just the basic tests your doctor might run routinely, to ask about things like advanced APO cholesterol testing.
And encouraging us to pay attention to those unseen foundational forces like gravity's subtle pull on our bodies, or that teeming world of microbes in our gut that we need to actively manage through diet.
Right. So maybe here's the final provocative thought for you to chew on, building on all that. We spent so much time today analyzing politicians fighting bitterly over legislative maps, over nominations, this constant struggle for total control, yeah. You know, a 5-seat gain here, the 140 plus appointments blocked there. It's all about power mapping.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we also learned about these fundamental, deeply nonpartisan forces that shape us every single day. Things like the silent pull of gravity on our digestion, or that unseen, incredibly complex world of microbes living inside our gut. These forces operate completely outside the political chaos.
So the question is, if you personally applied the same focus, the same determination, the same meticulous energy that politicians use to map political power, if you apply that to understanding and optimizing the silent foundational mechanics of your own physical well-being, your own financial health,
mm-hmm.
what kind of reset could that achieve in your life?
Think about where true fundamental control really lies for you. Is it in the headlines or is it closer to home?
That's a great question to end on. Thanks for joining us for this exhaustive deep dive into the pages of Newsmax for October 2025.
And thank you for learning alongside us. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.